It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Abby Hornacek.
I'm Ben Domenech.
I'm Dana Perino, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, November 9th, 2022. I'm Dave Anthony. It's the day after Election Day, and Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy is confident.
We will be in the majority, and Nancy Pelosi will be in the minority. Yeah!
But control of the Senate remains up in the air.
I'm Chris Foster. A young couple found murdered in Texas nearly 42 years ago is identified. But what about their baby, Holly?
Did somebody kidnap the baby? Did somebody kill the parents to kidnap the baby? What happened to the baby? Where is the baby? And so this cold case took on a totally new direction.
And I'm Jimmy Failla. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
The votes are still being counted, but Kevin McCarthy is confident.
It is clear that we are going to take the House back.
The House minority leader could become the next speaker if Republicans do end up in the majority.
Thank you to everyone who voted Republican for the very first time.
But it may not be the big red wave in the House that many in the GOP hoped for. At this point, Republicans have won about 200 seats, 30 more than Democrats, with dozens of races not called yet, but many lean blue. So the GOP may end up with just a small majority in the House. Which party controls the Senate? Still up in the air. Democrats scored a big win in Pennsylvania.
Thanks to all of you. All of you. Thank you. Thank you so much. They made me grateful right now.
John Fetterman beat Republican Dr. Mehmet Oz by a few points, flipping what had been a red seat held by Senator Pat Toomey, who's retiring, turning it Democrat blue. Other Democrat incumbents fended off GOP challenges, Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, Patty Murray in Washington State. Republicans did win a closely watched race in Ohio.
Really, I cannot say thank you enough. I cannot express possibly in words how grateful I am.
J.D. Vance beat Congressman Tim Ryan by about 6 points. Now, Congressman Ted Budd won in North Carolina for Republicans. So at this point, it's 48 seats won by the GOP, 48 won by Democrats, with 4 races still undecided. In Nevada, where about 2/3 of the vote has been counted so far, Republican Adam Laxalt is trying to unseat Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, and they are almost exactly tied. Arizona's Democratic Senator Mark Kelly has a lead over Republican challenger Blake Masters, with a lot more votes still to count. In Wisconsin, almost all the ballots are tabulated, and GOP Senator Ron Johnson is ahead of Democrat Mandela Barnes, so it is possible. Just like in 2020, control of the Senate could come down to Georgia.
We know how much is at stake in this election. So thank you for being with me, and I'm grateful that we are together every step of the way.
Senator Raphael Warnock has a several thousand vote lead over Republican Herschel Walker, but it appears neither will get 50%, which would trigger a runoff in December. So the 2020 midterm script is still being written early this morning. And now joining us is Colin Reed, a Republican strategist, former campaign manager for Scott Brown. Good morning, Colin.
Hey, Dave. Good to be here.
So what's your thought here? A lot of people expected that we would wake up this morning with a giant majority for Republicans in the House, and it may not be that way.
No, and rule 101 of politics is underperforming and over-delivering. And all the talk of the giant red wave cresting over the from sea to shining sea appears unlikely at this point in time. But there are some positive glimmers of hope for Republicans, especially in the state of Florida, where Governor DeSantis cruised to a 20-point win. Senator Rubio, similarly, 16-point margin of victory. And Florida has gone from being a quintessential swing state, the one that's always up for grabs, the one that always decides these presidential elections, to firmly ruby red. And there's a lot of takeaways from that. But one of the things that I think Republicans can take hope from is that the COVID policies, the pandemic policies implemented by Governor DeSantis and, frankly, Governor Kemp just up north in Georgia, who also had a similar margin of victory last night have been validated over time. And those are the policies that have aged better over time. And those are the policies that of that were we have the American people on our side. So Florida and Georgia, two really positive signs, two really positive outcomes coming out of last night. That much we know.
And I can understand that is something that Republicans are happy about. But COVID policy, those were not the big issues of the campaign. The economy, inflation, and then, of course, the Supreme Court's decision on Roe v. Wade, overturning the woman's legal right federally to get an abortion, letting states ban or restrict the procedure. That led to a lot of controversy over the summer. And that was, in the Fox News voter analysis, 70% of voters say the Supreme Court's decision was a factor, and abortion was, with 10% of the voters, the number one issue, second only to the economy. So that did, it seems, help Democrats. Would you agree?
Certainly. And it certainly did in blue parts of the country where Republicans did not do where they needed to do to get that that red wave to hit and happen. And I would say the battle lines going into this election were very clear. The Republicans wanted to argue and litigate this Joe Biden's handling of the economy, and the Democrats wanted to make a referendum on abortion and the Supreme Court's decision. And there's going to be plenty of time for pollsters and strategists to sift through the wreckage of Tuesday night. But one thing is clear is that the impact of the abortion decision it resonated more than I think some Republican candidates and campaigns were thinking or expecting.
Now, inflation was 93% for people that were out there. 93% of them had said that it was a factor in what their vote was. 85% said crime was a factor in their vote. Those were issues Republicans hammered over and over again. Do you think that they didn't do as well on those issues? Is it possible?
Well, one group of people who certainly did not do well, and for once again, is going to have decision, a lot of questions to answer, are the pollsters, because a lot of these races that were decided by wide margins were predicted to be nail biters going into Tuesday night. And much of that expectations, many of that anticipation was driven by the state of the economy. And it just seemed like, Dave, from Labor Day through Election Day, it was just one bad economic indicator after another. Mortgage rates kept going up. The inflation kept ticking in the wrong direction. Gas prices started going back up. Even the jobs numbers last week, last ones before the election, were not where they needed to be. So if you were looking through the lens of an economic measure, every single factor was going against the party in charge, which was the Democrats. And that's the reason there was so much hope going into Election Day for the Republican Party.
Though you have to say, with all that said, there was the report on economic growth showing that after two slight declines in three-month periods earlier in the year, in the third quarter, we actually had a bit of growth, which was a rebound, which President Biden certainly made a big deal of. And he's also talked about how there's been a lot of jobs created under his watch. Yes, it wasn't the big number in the last month we measured in October, but it also wasn't the big decline. People thought the job market was going to keep going down with the Fed raising rates, and that hasn't happened to a huge degree yet. The labor market is not horrible.
That may be, but the voters' perception in politics is reality, and every single metric showed that the voters weren't buying any of the positive spin out of the economy. It was clear they were feeling the pain, whether it was the soaring gas prices or the grocery bills or the never-ending inflation. So the economy it was always perceived as a weakness for President Biden. It's the reason he was kept so sidelined, I believe, on the campaign trail, because Democrats did not want him to be out there defending his handling of it, and that was what Republican candidates were meant to go out and prosecute. But look, ultimately, it appears likely at this point in time that there will be a Republican House, and that Republican House will be able to provide a check on the second half of the Biden administration. And at this point in time, it's still possible there is still a pathway to a Republican majority in the Senate. So all hope is not lost, but certainly it was not the result that many on the Republican side of the aisle were hoping for.
Now, on the Senate races, obviously, Adam Laxalt would have to win in Nevada and unseat Catherine Cortez Masto, right? That's you have to get that, or at least Mark Kelly losing to Blake Masters. You have to get one of those seats, right?
That's right. And then it appears, unfortunately, for the people of Georgia are going to be subject to five more weeks of television ads if that race is heads to a runoff, as it appears likely at this point in time.
Right. Although, I guess, if Blake Masters were to come back, he's down now, but they're, you know, it's we're talking here, it's about 4:30 in the morning or East Coast time. Votes are still being counted. It's possible that Blake Masters comes back. It's possible that Adam Laxalt wins. Ron Johnson has a lead. Most of the votes are counted in Wisconsin. It is theoretically possible that there are 51 Republican seats even before the runoff in Georgia. It is possible.
There are. If those three pieces fall into place, and then there still is the pathway to that Republican majority in the Senate. One thing that I think will be clear is this discussion and debate that we were having over the summer about candidate quality on the Senate side. Senator McConnell made some comments that got a lot of attention about candidate quality being paramount. That's a discussion and a debate that's going to be rehad because a lot of these candidates required a lot of money from national outside groups to win their races, frankly, in red parts of the country where they shouldn't have needed the help they did get. And that those resources, financial resources in a campaign are finite. And if you're spending money one place, you're not spending it elsewhere. So candidate quality should matter. These candidates in red parts of America, some of them should not have gotten or needed the help they got. And that's going to be one of the takeaways. I predict will be one of the takeaways we have in the coming days and weeks.
All right, let's get back into some of the governor's races. You mentioned Brian Kemp. He was a winner in Georgia. He beat back a challenge again in a rematch with Stacey Abrams, and he said this.
This election proves that when Republicans stay focused on real-world solutions that put hard-working people first, we can win now, but also in the future, y'all.
Texas, Greg Abbott, he beat Beto O'Rourke, so he was reelected. Ron DeSantis, you referenced that earlier, easy win in Florida, defeating Charlie Crist. But Democrats had their wins, too. Tony Evers reelected in Wisconsin. You had also Kathy Hochul winning in New York, Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. Any of those results a surprise to you?
The margin of victory for Governor Kemp is a surprise, or should be, is noteworthy because of the nature of that race last time. It was so close. Remember, Stacey Abrams refused to concede for years after the fact because she felt that the election was denied her. And Governor Kemp is someone who beat back a primary challenge in the spring, knocked off David Perdue, who was challenging him by about 50 points, and then just never looked back. But Georgia is a state that is red, but trending more purple. And it's also an example of somewhere where a governor can govern with conservative policies and principles. Remember, this was a guy who reopened the state before even the former President Trump wanted him to do during the COVID-19 and was criticized for it. And he's governed as a conservative and he's kept his head down. He's ignored a lot of the noise. And unlike past elections, these governors, the decisions they made over these terms, they were real decisions that people understood. They were decisions about schools being open, churches being open, businesses being open. And Governor Kemp was rewarded, and he offers a roadmap for many conservative governors in the months and years ahead.
Three quarters of voters in the Fox News voter analysis are not happy with the way government's working. That can't be a big surprise to you.
Well, it's not. And that was why there was so much optimism fueling the Republican side, because all the people or the overwhelming majority of Americans were unhappy about the direction of the country. And one party was pulling all levers of power. These midterm elections aren't terribly complicated. You just need to, as the out party, you just need to frame that as a referendum of the party in charge. And if you're able to do that successfully and offer yourself and your party as the acceptable alternative, you tend to have a pretty good night. And that was what was fueling and driving so many of these Republican hopes going into Election Day.
Yeah, only 43% of voters in the analysis approve of President Biden. For 65% of them, he was a factor in their vote. President Trump, former President Trump, was a factor in the vote for 58% of those out there.
Right.
I know we're barely hours from the voting of 2022, but here we go, a week from yesterday, 6 days from now, Donald Trump may announce that he's running for president again.
Well, that's right. The dust barely has it a time to settle on the current elections before we're already discussing the next one. And who knows what President Trump's going to do. He's said a number of different things that all signs appear like he's going to run. Certainly Governor DeSantis has the springboard he needs coming out of last night to successfully parlay this into a national run. And there'll be a slew of other candidates who get in to form another third lane there if you're breaking the presidential primary into lanes. And then, of course, what's going to happen on the Democratic side. One of the reasons the Democratic Party exceeded expectations was their ability to keep President Biden, their current sitting commander in chief, out of the limelight for most of the campaign. He was barely visible in the campaign trail, relegated to deep blue parts of America where he could do no harm. And now questions will turn to his future.
It's
very possible we have two wide open primaries on both sides.
It's also possible we have a rematch.
It is, and both men, both of the 2020 contenders have hinted at that and seem relishing at the prospect of a rematch. I'm not sure the rest of the country feels so feels the same way about that.
Yeah, I mean, you've seen the polls. What is it? Something like 2/3 of Democrats don't want President Biden as their nominee, and there are, and the Republican Party's what, pretty much split in half, right? There are about half Republicans really love former President Trump, and maybe half would mind seeing somebody else.
It's just so there's just no modern comparison for a former president, defeated former president, seeking another term in office. You have to go back to Grover Cleveland in the late 1800s to have the model replicated. And there's a huge swath of America who doesn't really like the idea of a 82-year-old versus a 78-year-old for the biggest job in the free world.
Yeah. But when you look at, we also don't usually have somebody announce a run for president this soon. We're not even in 2023.
Right. Typically the start of the new calendar year marks the official firing of the gun of the next presidential race. It seems as though that process could be accelerated now. Although those candidates who get in early, at least those who are running as challengers in a wide open field, they then set off the gun in terms of all sorts of financial requirements and reporting requirements. So there is a reason to wait until later in the process if you're able to. But of course, President Trump has always defied all political expectations and norms, and there's no reason to think he's going to stop now.
Well, it's going to be interesting. Colin Reed, Republican strategist, former campaign manager for Scott Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Jimmy Failla with your Fox News commentary coming up.
In the summer of 1980, Dean and Tina Klaus moved to Texas from Florida with their baby daughter, Holly. On January 12, 1981, the couple was found murdered just outside Houston, unidentified until last year.
I said, do you have a family member that might have been missing for a really long time from your family? And she said, oh my God, yes. Yes, my brother, Harold Dean Klaus Jr. And then almost immediately she said, well, what about his wife and his little girl? And then I said, well, wait, he had a baby?
There's a new Fox News podcast series about that mystery and the murder called What About Holly?
They were found together in the woods. The crime was absolutely brutal.
It's hosted by Fox News investigative reporter Christina Corbin.
He was beaten to death. She was strangled. And they were young. They 17 and 21 years old. And law enforcement had no idea who they were. So fast forward many years. In 2011, their bodies were exhumed from a potter's field in Houston, and a DNA profile was extracted from the remains, because at that time, these forensic anthropologists thought they might be able to use that DNA to find a match, but they were unsuccessful. And then fast forward to the fall of 2021, so this time 1 year ago, two genetic genealogists decided to give it another go, and they uploaded their DNA profile into GEDmatch, which is basically like a consortium of all these like consumer DNA databases, and they were able to find a distant relative of the male victim in Kentucky. And from there, They basically build out these elaborate family trees, and they were ultimately able to identify him as Harold Dean Clouse Jr. Well, when they called his family in Florida to tell them, the family said, oh my gosh, you know, we'd been wondering what happened to him all these years. Thank you for delivering this news to us. What about his wife? And they said, well, he was found with a young woman, so that they were able to piece together, well, that's Tina. And then it was the bombshell. Well, what about his missing 10-month-old baby?
Right. Investigators at that point were like, what baby? Because we're talking now, of course, with the benefit of hindsight. But these were just, again, like you said, a John and Jane Doe. And so now...
It changed the course.
Right.
It changed everything. So there was a child, and all sorts of questions came up. Well, was the child also killed and in the woods, and, you know, scavengers made off with her tiny body? Or did somebody kidnap the baby? Did somebody kill the parents to kidnap the baby? What happened to the baby? Where is the baby? And so this cold case took on a totally new direction.
So, obviously the family always wanted to know what happened. There was a suspicion that they may have just joined a cult and cut everybody off, right?
Yeah. So this couple, they grew up in Florida. They grew up in a small beach town on the Atlantic side of Florida called New Smyrna Beach. And when Dean was a teenager, he met this cult that was sort of traveling in the area at the time. And he actually traveled with the group for a year and then came back to his family. And then he meets Tina, and they get married, and they have a baby. And he decides to move to Texas because he tells his family he has a great job opportunity with a construction company in right outside of Dallas, in a town called Lewisville. So the family, you know, as far as they're concerned, there's no more cult in the picture. You know, this is something that he just encountered as a teenager and kind of got it out of the system, and that was the end of it.
So they think, okay, they're fine. They're off in Texas. It's before cell phones, so... You know, people didn't talk as much back then. You might get a letter, you might get a rare phone call. They were expensive.
Exactly. So they would write the occasional letter. And the family got a letter in October of 1980. And it was the last correspondence with the couple. And they never heard from them again. And then this very strange, bizarre encounter happened in early 1981. When Dean's mother, Donna Casasanta, got a phone call from a man who said that he'd found her car, a car she had loaned to Dean, abandoned in a suburb of Los Angeles. And he knew some people who could drive it back to her for $1,000. He didn't identify himself. Donna told me that he presented himself as an authority figure, but he didn't really give a name. And so she agrees to it, and she says, okay, well, you know, drive the car back. I live in New Smyrna. Let's meet, you know, a little bit north in Daytona at the Daytona Speedway, because that was, like, obviously a well-known landmark. So basically what ends up happening is this car comes in late at night, according to Donna, and there's these three robed women driving the car. And according to Donna, the older woman identified herself as Sister Susan. She said, I'm returning this car to you. Your son has joined our group, and he wants no contact with his family. So it wasn't until, you know, October of 2021 when the family got a phone call that, you know, this unidentified murder victim found in January of 81 was actually her son, their brother. And that was a big blow to the family. And then they quickly found out that Tina was also killed and that their baby was missing.
You spoke to the cult leaders. Is it Christ Family, it's called? Is that right?
So, yeah. So in this podcast, I interviewed a former member, Maureen Clark, who spent a year and a half with this group. I interviewed a woman we're identifying as MJ, who was a child when her parents joined this group. And unlike most other children, she was allowed to travel with the group for about a year and a half. So in this podcast, it was really important for me to actually speak with eyewitnesses, to actually speak with people who really were intimately familiar with the group and how it operated. And again, you know, I was speaking to this group not because I was looking to judge the group and its practices, but really because I wanted to answer one key question, was did this group have anything to do with, did they have any knowledge of the murders of Dean and Tina Clouse? And so that was really why I tried to do a deep dive into who they were.
Well, that's one leg of the mystery. You know, what happened to them was sort of, we know they're dead. We don't know how yet, though, right? And then the big one is the title of the podcast, What About Holly?
That's right. So the Texas Attorney General 2 years ago basically created a unit in his office that's entirely devoted to solving cold cases. And the unit is headed by senior counsel Mindy Monford, who basically attacked this case and went after it relentlessly from the very beginning. And it all came down to a birth certificate that they had to get a court order to unseal. And that ultimately led them to Holly. Major spoiler alert here. But in June of 2022, the Texas Attorney General's office announced that they had located Holly, that she was alive and well, living in Oklahoma, a married mother of five children.
And now it's a 42-year-old woman who lived a life having no idea that any of her parents' history. Well, just tell me about the podcast. It's called What About Holly? How many episodes? When are they out?
So the podcast is 9 episodes. This is a story that's a mystery wrapped in another and yet another and another. And we also explore sort of the whole field of genetic genealogy, how these cold cases are getting cracked now with much more frequently than they did, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, because you have these genetic genealogists who are able to, you know, basically take a DNA profile and, you know, upload it and see if there's any kind of familial match with a relative in another state, and then build out these family trees and then ultimately identify victims. Also, what I came to find out in my research, my investigation here, was that there are currently more than 14,000 unidentified remains in America. And so it is a big problem in this country, and one that, you know, people refer to as sort of a silent disaster. It's something I certainly knew very little about, if anything, before I dove into this story.
Yeah, and now going forward, we're going to have just more and more and more of these family reunions and stories. But thanks a lot for coming on, Christina, the host and journalist behind the podcast, What About Holly? You can get it where all your favorite podcasts are found. Good to talk to you, Christina.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. Nothing says holly jolly Christmas like pouring out a cold one right from your Christmas tree. At least that's the theory behind a new holiday offering from Miller Lite. The beer company launched its holiday collection, and this year it's including a holiday tree keg stand filled with draft Miller Lite. As described by the press release, it's a fully functional tree stand that fits around a quarter barrel keg. Its sides festooned with the Miller Lite logo, and its design makes it seem as if beer is being poured from the tree. The stand goes on sale this week for $50. The company says the stand is compatible with trees up to 5 feet, and they'll only have a limited quantity of it. Miller's parent company, Molson Coors, is no stranger to holiday offerings. Last year's beer-naments were a hot-ticket item, with each batch of the limited edition drinkable ornaments selling out almost immediately. If you missed out last year, they say they're bumping up its inventory this year and the capacity. The beer-naments will now be able to fit 12-ounce standard cans. 6-packs will be bought online for $35.50, and a new batch will be released weekly until December 6th. For those not old enough to drink, or if you need a little extra swag, so-called ugly holiday sweaters, beanies, socks, and a polo shirt will also be up for grabs. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jimmy Failla.
What's on your mind?
So President Biden called an early lid on Election Day, didn't do too many media events, or as it's known in Washington, the usual. Seriously, my son works harder as president of his fantasy football league than Biden does as president of the United States. But in this instance, I'm not complaining, because when Biden calls an early lid, it gives a sign language interpreter a badly needed rest. Think about it. That poor interpreter has to make up new signs every time Biden makes up new words. Plus, the presidential band gets a reprieve from all those extra renditions of Hail to the Chief they have to play while Joe gets lost trying to find his way off stage. Now, I mentioned Biden going off stage because now that the midterms are done, our political focus moves on to 2024, where no serious person thinks Biden will be running. I know he said he's running, but as I said, no serious person thinks he's running. Not only does Joe not have the ability, but he doesn't have the record. Think about that. The Democrats made the centerpiece of these entire midterms, vote for us or the Republicans are going to ban elections. It was absurd on its face because no Republican anywhere has vowed to ban elections. Although we wouldn't mind picking up the pace on the vote count a little bit, which is why if Biden really wanted to do something productive with his remaining time in office, he should devote his energy to a bipartisan vote counting measure that would spare the country from the chaos that engulfs our elections these days. After all, Biden's taken enough breaks in his presidency. The least he could do is give us one. Be sure to listen to Fox Across America with me, Jimmy Failla, weekdays from noon to 3 on the Fox News app or foxacrossamerica.com.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.